Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
Hello and welcome to Season 4 of the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
This podcast is all about elite distance running in the UK.
We're here to give you all the latest news updates around the sport,
as well as weekly interviews with athletes and coaches.
Stay up to date by following us on Instagram and X at Sunday Podcast.
And make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel too, where we post athlete workout videos, shoe reviews and more.
Thanks for listening, and as always, we hope you enjoy the episode.
Hello, welcome back to another episode. As you can see from the clickbaity title, Steve Cram on the pod this week. But no, in all seriousness, Matt did sit down with Steve, and that is coming up later on. So Matt, you spoke to him about the IFRI Festival of Miles, is that right?
Yeah, we're now called, a little bit of a rebrand, I guess, called the Bannister Miles now. Obviously, 70 years coming up. We mentioned it a few times. It's going to be an absolute mega event. The elite fields are starting to come together. Keep an eye on their Instagram because they're going to be releasing kind of what elites are going for it. And more importantly than that, yeah, we spoke to Cram and Tom Barrett, who Oxford student is kind of directing and organizing or co-directing and organizing the event. And they've done a fantastic job at taking it from where it was last year, which is very much, yeah, it was called IFRI Festival of Miles. They merged with the BMC for a little bit. And like, it was, you know, there were some good mile races and they wanted a sub-4. We didn't quite get that last year. But I think 2024, 70 years on from Bannister, I think we're definitely going to get a sub-4 looking at that elite field. So that's kind of like a minimum. So here kind of how the event has changed over the last year. They've got funding. They're going to have a mass community mile in from the town centre, which is going to finish at IFRI as well. Closed roads. So it's a fast road mile for those who want to do a road mile over a track mile as well. And then obviously Cram on the pod, mate.
Love it.
So big fish.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wasn't unable to chat to Crammy, so I had to let Matt do that. So maybe for some of you listening, you'll prefer that, to be fair. Matt with the hard questions.
I don't know. Me and Tom had a good chat with him, and I got to give all credit to him, to be honest, for sort of reaching out, getting the connection, and he very much got Cram on the podcast for us for promotion for Bannister Miles. But obviously, yeah, it's a great guest for us to have on as well. So, it's funny, like we talk about Cram's career back then and what it was like growing up in an era, I think, with Seb Coe and Steve Ovett, and it's very similar. I mean, Tom made a great point that those athletes who are coming through today in the 1500, they're living in a very similar era to what Cram was living in when you had two massive names. And I feel like right now we've got two world champions in Whiteman and Kerr. And I feel those coming through, it's kind of like, how do you become that last man in the trio? If that makes sense. And that was very much Cram in his early part of the career. So he talks about that and how he was able to actually sort of become himself and not try to mold himself into a Ovett or into Coe. He just sort of became his own unique athlete and sort of brought his own strengths to the table.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll get into that later on in the episode. But firstly, Matt, I don't think we ever spoken about this on the podcast. Are you Coe or Ovett, mate?
I'm more of an Ovett fan all day long. I mean, I've actually got some quite... Coe is a great runner and a great athlete, but like, I've got some strong opinions about Coe. even like just, you know, he's heading up World Athletics. You know, he's, I just don't know how much of a good a job he's doing. It's obviously a very difficult job. But yeah, there's just been some rogue decisions from him, which have frustrated me and almost tainted my opinions on him. Because for someone who even comes from that distance background as well, like, I feel like there's actually been several attempts to kind of damage the distance running scene over the last few years. And that's obviously, that's coming from somewhere. And with a man like him in charge, I would have thought he'd try and like really boost that distance running scene profile. And even with like, you know, stuff like the World Cross and stuff like that, again, like I would have thought he'd be finding ways to really take that upper level. And I thought we were going to see that when we saw Ahearst and stuff in 2019. So anyway, so I guess that's kind of tainted my opinions on Coat. Obviously, I think they're both great athletes and as well, and very inspiring for us to kind of look back on. But yeah, I mean, Ovette, I just thought he was raw. He never tried to like please anyone. He was just himself. And yeah, he was just a great racer as well and a great personality. Plus, I love reading about him and Harry Wilson, the coach, and learning about that relationship and kind of how Ovette trained and stuff. Whereas I feel like Co, do we actually know like what he did and how he trained? There's all sorts of rumors out there and sessions that he might have done, but I feel like a lot of it is, we don't actually get the kind of full picture.
I mean, there is Peter Coe's book, Winning Running. I was actually just looking over at my bookshelf from in the office, and I've got that there. So I'd say I'm more of a Coe fan personally, but I take your point about the about some of the stuff since his career with the IAAF. But definitely Perfect Distance, if anyone's not read it, go check that out for kind of, I guess, a younger audience. Because that's the thing with me and you as well, mate. Obviously, we had to learn about these athletes past their careers. So I guess it's just we're based on our opinions off a few YouTube documentaries and books.
Yeah, there are some good YouTube documentaries, actually. Was it? I remember seeing one with Seb Coe. What was that one called again?
I can't remember. I remember we used to watch it all the time.
Yeah, yeah, I've watched it. It's good.
Smashing in 800-meter hill reps in Sheffield. So
800 meters. So I didn't he do 800s downhill or something to get his cadence going. He did some cool stuff. But then like, and then Cram comes along and he's just a bit of a freak of a talent and worked extremely hard. And I think actually Cram makes that point is, you know, I think a lot of people were like, oh, he's just talented. And I think the same with Ovette, and Cram sort of said, no, we, that obviously I had some talent, but we actually worked very, very hard. And it gives us an idea of how hard he worked and what sessions he put in, etc. So I think that's quite eye-opening as well.
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of people like that, aren't they? And they do it still today. Like we're probably guilty of it sometimes. We talk about athletes being super talented, but I don't think people should be under any illusions that people are getting to like the top Olympic like finals without putting in serious hard work alongside that talent.
And yeah, we kind of, I agree with that. And one final area that, you know, as we near track season, is worth discussing is that 800, that men's 800 at the moment. And I just feel like since Rhodesia, you know, Rhodesia, even pre-Rhodesia, it just hasn't moved on in all these years. It's quite weird. And Crown was the perfect guy to talk about. I mean, all those years ago, he ran 142.8. Like, we haven't seen a Brit run that fast in decades. And so I think, and it's worth,
they were training like 1500 guys back then though.
Exactly. And I think he said the same, and Botterill last week, you know, it's an endurance event. And Cram's a firm believer of that. So it's interesting to get his take and why people don't do the 8:15 double as well, as much.
Yeah. But I think it's like, as quick as Rhodesia was, you're not telling me he couldn't have run a ridiculous 15. Like in the right race.
I think he wouldn't have broken 3:30, mate. He wouldn't have broken 3:30. He was just too big, too fast. To like carry that for three and three quarter laps would have been just too much.
I don't know though. As powerful as Rhodesia was, he's still a little bit lopey. Like,
man, I don't think he could. I remember don't you remember, like, he was like training with Brother Coleman, and he was just like, Coleman was like, yeah, so we'll probably run a 2-minute 800 here, And like, and Radish was like, whoa, I was waiting for him. Jogs around in like two.
There's some good YouTube documentaries as well, actually, the Radish ones.
Yeah, so I don't think his obviously he must have had good endurance and like did do a lot of fartleks and stuff, didn't he? So, but we'll never know because he was just such a pure 800 meter beast. But but it is interesting, you know, that 800, 1500 double not as popular. And
I think Warholm runs a good 800.
No, he doesn't. Again, he can't. He won't carry himself past 500 meters. He just produces too much.
I don't know, mate. I don't know. I think the hurdlers have extra strength though.
No, but what you need to remember is they just train themselves in lactate all the time. So he literally, even if he runs a 6400, he's probably producing quite high lactic levels. He would. He'd be, you know, and so like he can't. He almost can't go slow enough. Like I would hate to see his, you know, his lactate count or lactate threshold.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's the best way. I do think that 8:15, like your Jake Wyman, for example, is the way to go. I still do think a few of those guys would run well.
Yeah. Well, let's pretty much get into the episode. Me and Baz have a little chat beforehand, break down the Iffley miles, break down the Bannister miles, hence why I haven't done it too much now. And then we'll move on to getting cram on and finding all about the kind of golden era, if you like, and what it was like to be a part of that. But just a quick message to those of you listening that at the Bannister miles, there will be a few world record holders present. Hisham El Garouj, the current world record holder in the mile, will be present. He will be watching. He'll be at Iffley Road. So it's almost worth coming just to see him in the flesh. Maybe you'll pick his brains in the stands. Obviously, there's going to be food. There's going to be drink. It's going to be a fantastic evening. I think those elite races get off at about 5-6 o'clock. And then Cram's going to be there himself. Philbert Bailly as well is going to be there. And Nuruddin Morceli as well. So, and you know, you think they are four greats in the sport that you're going to be able to mix with, chat to, and pick their brains. Hopefully, I know I'll certainly be wanting to do that. But if you can't make it, there'll be a live stream as well.
Can you get El Garouj to sell my Eldorados, mate?
Mate, send them over. Yeah, we can put out some of the OG spikes, OG victories, OG milers. We'll get El Garouj to sign them up, and oh gosh,
we should do that. Sign, get him to sign my Eldorados, and we'll do a giveaway.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask El Garouj all about how that guy trains. You know, God, his battles with what is it, Noen and Yengi, Wen and Genny. And
do you know what that the El Garouj, speaking of YouTube documentaries, that El Garouj one, it's like the Olympic something.
Yeah,
I
yeah,
remember,
yeah.
But so that good. Is yeah. So good. If anyone's not seen that, I don't know, just type in El Garouj documentary on YouTube. It's unreal.
Yeah, man. So, when he's just full tracksuit training in the forest in Morocco, just ripping 600s on the grass. Just, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, we digress as always, but enjoy this episode and we'll catch you very soon.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. We are, 70 years ago, Bannister, an Oxford student, did the unthinkable. We broke that 4-minute mile barrier. I'm joined by two very, very special guests today. Tom Barrett, who is organizing the event, and Steve Cram, who you all know who he is. He needs no introduction. But Baz, I mean, anniversaries of the event, they've come and gone. We've all been witness to them. But how is 2024 shaping up? We're 70 years since that magical moment now. And what can we expect that's going to be different to previous iterations?
That's right, yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. Firstly, it's a pleasure to be on the pod finally. So yeah, I'm organising this year's 70th anniversary with another Oxford student, Tom Renshaw. And as you say, there's been anniversaries before, the 40th and 50th, and they were kind of led by Bannister himself. So there was an athletics meet that happened on the anniversary date, and Bannister would invite all of the mile world record holders back to Oxford to kind of meet him and spend some time with him in Oxford, where he made history in 1954. And obviously this is a significant anniversary, and it's the first one where sadly Bannister's not actually going to be there. And as a result, I think it's only appropriate that we start to really scale up this event and start to make it the most fitting kind of celebration of his legacy that we possibly can, which is why we're expanding it massively to include a mass participation race down the high street in Oxford. Our elite races are looking like they're going to be a pretty high standard. We're introducing a new 1 mile steeplechase event, which should be incredibly exciting and hopefully sets the groundwork for someone going sub four on the steeple in a few years' time. And then obviously we've got the returning world record holders, as with previous years, and excited to announce that we've got Steve Cram obviously joining us, and Hisham El Gharouj is going to be coming back to Oxford May 6th this year to watch the celebrations unfold.
Bloody hell, mate. Well, I'm certainly excited to meet these people. I mean, are people going to be able to interact with these mile world record holders on the day as well? Are they going to be milling around?
Definitely, yeah. They're going to be walking around the track all day, meeting people, meeting yourself, watching the action unfold. We've got a few Oxford boys obviously going in the elite men's race, so I think it's going to be pretty cool for them to see Hisham El Gharouj, watching them try and break the 4 minute barrier. I was joking with the lads earlier in the week that I think he's going to be pretty unimpressed if they run 3:59, given his 3:43 clocking. But yeah, it should be a cool one for them if they can dip under four for the first time ever on the very spot where Bannister did it 70 years to the minute, with Cram, Morcelli, El Gharouj, all watching them do it.
Yes, mate, we're working on it. We'll keep the pressure off the lads for now. We'll maybe have a good episode after. Hopefully they can break that 4 minute mile. But perhaps a good time actually to talk about the history of those mile times run at Iffley Road, because we haven't, although obviously Bannister was the first, we haven't seen too many sub fours since Bannister. And we've had a lot of elite athletes, you know, world record holders and world champions turn up and not be able to crack that 4 minute mark.
Yeah, it's true. We've had some pretty impressive runs at Iffley. Track records. Greg Mottram from 2004 at the 50th anniversary ran a 3:56, which, looking at some of the guys we've got in the elite field this year, is hopefully in danger of being broken. We've had two Oxford students do it in history, Greg Masbach being the most recent, I believe, and obviously he went on to run 3:52 while he was still a student at university, which is just absolutely nuts. But yeah, it's a track full of history, and I was kind of thinking about this the other day, and I think that athletics needs to make more of these venues that are so historic, and athletics is full of history, and the mile is the kind of the leading event on that. And we've got these events like the Dream Mile in Oslo and Bowman in Oregon, and I think Bannister Miles in Iffley is kind of the next one on that list of places that the world's best milers should be looking to come and run a fast time.
Without a doubt, mate. And it's been going, I mean, you brought back the Iffley Festival of Miles a few years ago now. You've built that up nicely, and then this year is just going to be off the scales. Are you hoping to continue this? You know, obviously it's a 70th anniversary, but you're hoping to continue this going forward as well into 2025 and beyond. People can count on a fast mile around this time of year and hopefully be able to watch some elites as well.
For sure. I think when we brought it back as Iffley Festival of Miles a few years ago, it was a group of students that kind of organized it in our spare time, and it was a bit of a kind of passion project, and we always viewed it as an event that was going to grow to even bigger than it is this year. And that's still the mindset, that we want it to be the biggest mile race in the UK. And I think that's achievable. And hopefully by introing things like the community mile, the mass participation, we're going to start to have thousands of people coming to Oxford every year for this event. And hopefully they stick around and watch the elites tear it up in the afternoon.
Yeah, we'll get Cram on now, but I just got to finish up and say, you know, you've all done a fantastic job. I mean, you and Redshaw heading it up, but it's been more than just you two. And like you said, getting Iffley Festival of Miles off the ground the last few years, but creating what you have this year, I think it's going to be a very, very special day. And not open to the public, but you've even got, you know, the garden party the day before, where you're going to have alumni, previous world record holders, and very, very loads of famous people attending. And I think there's very few athletics meets in the world which kind of offer that heritage.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty proud to have World Athletics come in to give us a few of their plaques to remember a few things. We've got one for Bannister himself to celebrate the 4 minute mile, and the other one is recognizing Oxford University Athletic Club as one of the oldest clubs in the world, and kind of recognizing their contribution to the sport. And credit goes to Renshaw for sorting that one out. And we're delighted to have a representative from World Athletics coming to present that and do some speeches. And sadly, Seb can't join us, but he's sent a lovely video message for us to play on the day, which will hopefully be pretty cool for the people in the stadium to watch.
Fantastic. And then actually, mate, let's just talk about the event a little bit, because we've got some great elites lined up. Obviously, we've got a load of races as well before the elites, and we've got the mass mile in the morning. But what can people expect? We got beers going, we've got live music, we're going to have crowd. What, in lanes 4 and 5?
Yeah,
I think that's probably the safest way, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Yeah, we're going to have barriers all around the track, crowd on the track watching. We've kind of, I'm not ashamed to admit that we've always used Highgate as inspiration for this event. I think they were leading the way, really, in how a kind of single distance event can operate and be more than just athletics. And we're going to have a museum on the infield, which is a pretty unique experience. It's going to be full of memorabilia from history. We've got Faith Kipyegon on spikes. We've got some of Bannister's items. We've got like Diane Lever Charles's vest from when she ran the first 5 minute mile as a woman. And that's going to be pretty cool for fans to look around. We've got an elite para race happening, which is cool. It's kind of a decent opportunity for those people to race in a setting where they're all together. I was at the London Diamond League last year, and it was super cool to see them all in a race together. And from chatting to a few of them and some people at EA and stuff, that's an opportunity that's really valued by the para athletes. So it's a no-brainer really for us to put on an elite para race at Bannister Miles and put it right up next to our elite able-bodied race. And we've got a pretty strong T20 field that are going to be racing. We've got some good junior races, the BMC Trophy, Peter Coe, Frank Horwell Miles are going to be happening throughout the day. And then obviously at 6 p.m. culminates with the final race of the day, which is the International Men, which will be 70 years to the minute since Bannister started his famous race.
Fantastic, mate. It sounds absolutely amazing. Obviously, I'm going to be there. You're going to be there. And we hope everyone else listening can get themselves out of Oxford on the 6th of May to check out the museum, meet the best in the world, ex-milers, world record holders. And finally, let's get Cram on now, British record holder in the miles. So no better man, really, to discuss about the history of the mile event and his career as well. So, Steve, a warm welcome to the podcast. And perhaps we should start with, you know, your current British record holder over the mile. And how did you get into running? How did it all start for you as a miler?
Oh, wow. If I can remember that long ago. To be honest, I loved all sport. I was massively into football. And then, you go from your junior school to senior school, and they make you go out and do cross country, don't they? And all of, I was never, when you're in junior school, everything's short stuff, sprints and things. I wasn't very quick, so I didn't think I was a good runner. And then suddenly you get kicked out in the class to do cross country, and I came back first. I was like, ooh, this is good. I got to represent the school against some other schools when we were doing cross country events. Wasn't winning those, but was, you know, up there. And then come the summer season, I actually ran 400 meters, not the mile. I don't know why. And I'm not even sure you could run the mile for the sort of 11, 12 year olds. Anyway, ran the 400. I get motivated by people, I always have done. And the first race I ran, I got beat by a lad from another school who I knew was a really good footballer. Still remember his name, Brian Heron, ginger lad, was a very good footballer. And the next week I thought, right, I'm not going to let him beat me again. And I bust a gut to try and beat him. I did. And I didn't know that Brian was already in the athletics club. And the guy from the athletics club who became my coach, Jimmy Headley, was watching. And he was like, why don't you come to the athletics club? And I didn't even know there was one. But it was a great place to go 2-3 nights a week and start racing on Saturdays and loved it all. It was a very different world to football, where I was doing well individually rather than, I'd been in a good team and enjoyed all of that. But the running just suddenly became a thing you did by yourself. And it just suited my personality, I guess. And I enjoyed the athletics club. It was very much a bit like a youth club. It was a good place to go 2-3 nights a week. So I got hooked pretty quickly.
Amazing. And you're obviously an incredibly successful junior. I'm just wondering, how did you manage moving into the senior ranks with Coe and Ovett obviously winning titles? Ooh. And how hard is it going to be for the kind of young Brits today with Kerr and Whiteman dominating as well?
Yeah, well, if you look at that as a negative, I had a very good junior career, as you said, but it only really took off when I was about 16. I was doing well, but then I sort of broke the British age group record at 16, and then at 17, something similar happened, and then I went to Commonwealth Games. And So you get catapulted, you know, still at school, and then you're going to major championships. And Konovet weren't actually running those. They decided there was two championships at some of the Europeans and the Commonwealth. So I didn't even get to meet them at my first championships, which was, but I would, you know, they were already big stars and we're already watching them. They're sort of 4 and 5 years older than me. But, and they, I guess they were an inspiration rather than anything else. I didn't see it as, and athletics was becoming very popular on television, and you know, so you're involved in something that was you know, people were watching, and you know, even as a 17-year-old, I was on the back page of the Daily Mirror, which might not sound a big thing these days, but back then was a, you know, it was a big deal, and you know, millions of people were aware of what you were doing, even at a young age. So there were two good things, I guess. One was that I got used to media coverage at a very young age, but without the pressure. So, you know, when I did go to the Olympics in as a 19-year-old, nobody was trying to make out, because they were all concentrating on Konovet, you know, so there was no pressure to say, oh, you know, he should be winning a medal. I mean, I got to the final. That was as good as, you know, I could do. But it meant I could develop in my own space. You know, I was very, very good, precocious talent, but and everybody was really pleased with what you were doing. But because we had these two guys winning, there was no pressure on me to, you know, if they weren't there, imagine the tension you're going to get. You know, you're a, I don't know, an Emma Raducanu or something, where the expectation goes woof through the roof. And it's quite hard to live with that. And then I think the other thing was, I'm just one of those people who, you know, I look at, when I did get to meet them and get to know them better, you look at them and you go, all right, you know, they look like me and didn't talk like me, but you know, they you know, they're not freaks of nature or anything. And also you get inspired in the way that you kind of go, wow, wouldn't it be great to be doing what they're doing? So it wasn't a case of necessarily going, oh my God, you know, I can't be as good as them. It was that they were setting a very high benchmark, which it meant even as a developing 18, 19, 20-year-old, I couldn't like rest. You know, they were up here and I had to try to get, just to get in the British team, you know, you had to be very, very good. So they were very good actually for my career, in the sense that they provided a pathway that I could see. And it wasn't as though, you know, you were growing up going, oh, you know, they're Kenyan or they're Ethiopian and they're going to, that's why they dominate and therefore I can't be as good as that. There was none of that. So I saw it as a good thing. And I would say the same thing to any young athletes now. And I think what Josh and Jake have done is exactly the same. They've dragged everybody else along with them. You know, if you wound the clock back 10, 15 years, the depth in men's 1500 meter running, you know, after our era has been really poor for a long time. And now all of a sudden, we're back to a situation where to get on the team, you know, you've got to be good, very, very good. And probably if you're pulling on a British vest at the Olympic Games in the 8 or the 1500, you've got a chance of a medal, at least, you know. So, and that's where we were at. And it's, you know, it's great that we're back in that. So I think what those two guys have done is just shown everybody else what's possible.
How did you, you know, on that, how did you negotiate being Steve Cram, if you like? How did you negotiate not trying to copy or emulate what Steve Ovett or Seb Coe was doing and actually just become your own runner?
I think I was different to both of them in terms of I had a bit of Steve in me, in like Steve came from a bit of a cross-country background, which I did, Seb less so. Seb was very different though. He was, you know, he was seen as more of an 800 runner moving up to the 15. Ovett was more of a 1500 runner who could run good 800s. And so I probably identified with him as an athlete a little bit more, but probably a lot more. But I realized that I had different skills, as people would say these days, to the two of them. So I had to learn to run the way which worked for me, and also learning to combat their, you know, attributes. Steve was a sit and kicker, you know, he had great acceleration. So how do you get rid of that? Seb was always more tricky because he could do both. You know, he probably wasn't as as quick off the mark as Ovette, like that 5 meter acceleration, but he could run from the front, he could sit and so you then learn to develop your own way of running, but you also have to make sure that that is going to be good enough to contend or beat the way other people runs. And that's one of the things I've always loved about 1500 meter running, having watched Ingebrigtsen and what Jake did and what Josh did, I would have loved to, like them, I would have loved to have been running against Ingebrigtsen in this, in this era, because he's actually quite one-dimensional, and I don't mean that in the to run him down. He's a phenomenal athlete, and he's incredibly hard to beat. But the point is, you can beat him, particularly in the major championships, and you beat him by developing your skills because you know what's probably going to come from him. So that's what the guys have done. They've gone, if I'm going to beat him, I have to be able to do X, Y, and Z. So Jakobsen is, in everything he's been doing to move the event on, and and the incredible things he does and has done, he's taken those guys with him. But of course, then when you get to a championships, there's always going to be one of them out of that group of three or four who probably are going to be sitting on his shoulder with 200 to go. So that's and that that's why I love the 1500. It is about you, as you said, you're being Steve Cram, being doing the things that you want to do, but it's also working out what everybody else is capable of. I had Conor Ovette, and then I had Saïd Awita, and I had Steve Scott, and I had people, all of these guys were right up there running world record pace. And you have to work, how do I beat him? How do I beat him? How do I beat him? Which is what I still love about it.
And is it fair to say that there's only a handful of athletes in the world who can actually look at other people and say, right, I'm going to try and combat their strengths? Because especially in this modern day, a lot of people are running fast, but it's fair to say a few of them aren't
Yeah.
thinking about tactics on race day. They're just trying to run fast.
Yeah, and I think in our day it was the reason I said it would be nice to be running there is because it ain't going to be, I won the world championships in, I think, 3:42 or something, with a stupid fast last lap, and we jogged for the first, and you probably don't get that these days. But yes, you need to know how to go to a championships, run three races, negotiate through your heats, where your heats could be very slow. So do you have the pace, and do you have the race craft to guide yourself through? I mean, remember when Josh Kerr, when he's medal in Tokyo, he nearly got knocked out in the heats. He was very lucky to get through. Jake's had a couple of scares, and so negotiating, you've got to be good enough in the 1500 to kick off a slow pace, to go at the front if you have to. Do you need to make the pace go a bit quicker, to be able to hang in when somebody is running world record pace, and can you hang on to that? So yeah, the best athletes are the ones who can do all of those things. Fast times in Diamond Leagues, it ticks one of the boxes, but it's probably, I ignore people's PBs and things, and you kind of go, how do they race? How many times do they win? How many times are they, that's what you're looking for in a really top-class athlete.
What would you say that your greatest achievement was in the sport then?
Yeah, do you know what? It's when you say your greatest achievement, I think our sport is about, is if you get to the end of your career and you think, I've managed to get to be as good as I think I could be. I think I could have probably run a bit quicker, but and I certainly could have had less injuries, and you can go through all of that sort of stuff. And as a one-off race, if that's the question, that's always hard to pick out. If I said one-off race, I tend to go, I think the World Championship 1500 final, because of that reason I just said, it was a lot of, you're trying to beat the best guys. It's a slow tactical race. You've got to use your brain. You've got to, all of those things. And you might laugh. I'll go, what was my greatest achievement? Running 1:42.8 for 800 meters. That was, for me personally, you'd kind of go, because I didn't think of myself as an 800 meter. So there's lots of things that kind of pop out when that you become really proud of. I would have hated to have finished my career not having broken the world record for the mile, because I grew up with Roger Bannister, and you know, that all the books I read and the videos, there were films that you know, my coach made me watch, of like the 50s and the 60s and all these great people and the heritage of the mile, and then what Cornel Vett were doing. And so I would, so doing that was immense. But I think if you wrap them all up, you kind of go, the biggest thing any athlete should be trying to do is to have a career where you've shown how good you can be, you know, because for a lot of people, they don't quite get to that, either through injury, their own, you know, lack of either commitment or whatever, or bad coaching, or, you know, there can be a lot of reasons why you think, that person, you know, should have done better, could have done better. And I think that would be more frustrating. But for me, I'm happy that I did pretty well.
Absolutely. I'm interested in the kind of 800 comment there, because you've obviously said you didn't really think of yourself as an 800 runner. But I mean, for a 15 guy, 142 today would just be exceptional. And, you know, Jake's kind of leading the way with a 143. Do you think that the way the 1500s run has changed a bit, and that the kind of 800 speed is maybe not as important as it was when you were winning the world title?
Yeah, I guess because there are less tactical races, both on the circuit, everything's paced, and you know, we've got wave lights and all the rest of it, and that gets replicated very much at championships. So yeah, I think in my day I would have said, if you can't run 144 comfortably, you know, regularly, then you're a bit of a disadvantage. I still think if Ingebrigtsen had I've spoken to him about this a little bit, you know, but he's obviously 5,000 is he goes to champs, he's running both of those events, so he wants to be really strong. Because it gets quite hard, I think, to run much quicker at the 1500 if you can't run regularly 144, 145, which he doesn't really do. I mean, he does stuff in training which replicates some of that. But it's also about, the great thing about the 800s as well is it teaches you that, you know, the moving at pace thing. So you can get a scenario where, you know, you've literally jogged two laps and then bang. And it happens indoors quite a lot. You know, it's in 800 meters or in a heat, you know, you might get a very slow first 600, 700, 800 meters, and then it becomes an 800 meter race. So how good are you at this? You know, so I still think, generally speaking, a top class 1500 meter runner should be able to run a very good 3000, a half decent five, certainly, but a very good 3000 meters, be world class at that event, and you should be world class at 800. You might not be the best, but you should be world class. And if your training gives you the ability to do those two things, then the 1500 will take care of itself. You know, I think that's. And that's why the 1500 is great, because we get some people who come from that more distance strength background and coming to the 1500, for whom the 800 is a bit of a stretch. And then you've got the 800 guys who've moved up to the 1500, for whom, you know, the faster pace at 1500 or perhaps rounds become a bit of an issue.
Would you like to see more athletes try and attack that 800, 1500 double? It's almost gone out of fashion a little bit, hasn't it? And it's now, you know, Jakob's made it the 15 and 5K double.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things. They changed the championship schedule to, it was, I blame El Garouge, because it goes all the way back about 20 years ago, where he wanted to, if you remember in Paris, 2003, the world champs, you won't remember it, too young. He wanted to try the double. And so the schedule got changed, so the 1500 went earlier, so he could come back and do the 5000. We've kind of stuck with that in the modern era. It's changed a couple of times, so therefore the guys on the circuit, you see, certainly, you know, the Jake Whitemans and Josh Kurt, to some extent, they know when to run some 800s on the circuit because it suits their program, you know, and they want to post those 145s, maybe 144s if they can, because they know that that's helping. But at the championships, it's now, it just doesn't sit. The program isn't designed for the 8 and 15 double, which is a bit of a shame, because I think there are some great athletes. It's the same on the women's side as well. You know, even someone like Laura Muir, you know, could do a lot of damage at 8 and 1500, whereas they've had the same, it follows the same sort of path.
So I guess the meet directors just have to accommodate the superstars. Do you agree with that then? If the superstar announces they want to do a 200, 400 double, for example, and an 815 double, they might change. But up until then?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably up to the World Athletics in terms of the schedule. But the schedule, the way they try to do it, if you take the 5,000 as an example, they've moved it later. But in our days, it was towards the end as well, because you put the 10,000 needs to be, they want that 10,000, 5,000 double, but they also want the 1,500, 5,000. So the 5,000 brings together, you know, the Ingebrigtsens and
Varegas, Chipta guys, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I suppose, I was nearly going to say, wouldn't it have been good in the old days to see Mo Farah racing Ingebrigtsen or racing Josh Kerr, and Josh would do a five. He might do. But, you know, you get my drift. So I think their view is we can get the doubling up, if you mean. Mm. We can get the distance guys coming, the 1,500 guys. But on the circuit, yeah, I think there is a lot of pressure the way, you know, the Diamond League is structured now and the way world rankings are becoming or have become a big determinant of how people get to championships and also how people get invited to meet. So unless you're the really top stars, you get pigeonholed in your event. Mm. And it's actually quite hard, even for a Jake Whiteman outside of the UK. If Jake said, I wanted to be in the Diamond League in the 800, they're probably going to go, well, hang on, Jake, you know, there's 15 people have run quicker than you. So, you know, what your world ranking position in the 800 is 45th or whatever it might be. So, no, thank you very much. Can you not just run the 1500? You know, you have to be more flexible these days. And that's why I like what Josh does and Jake as well. You know, they very much get a program, which is how I always operated back then. You're chasing the big medals. You're not chasing, you know, a few quid, more than a few quid, but you're not kind of jumping through hoops on the Diamond League circuit. You're picking your races based on, I want to be ready for the Olympics or the World Championships, which is the right thing to do.
Amazing. I want to ask you a bit about that period in 1985 when you broke three world records in 19 days. How did it feel firstly to do that? Did you know you were coming into that kind of shape, and which one of the records was kind of the big one that you'd had targeted and were most proud to get?
Yeah, it was an amazing season. You know, it was the fallow year, no championships. So you didn't have to kind of get ready for August the 21st, or you'll go back to what I just said a few minutes ago. So you had a bit of a free rein, you know, get yourself in shape. And then, I mean, again, come back to what I just said, you know, I decided I was in good shape, but I was having some problems with my calves that summer. It was a carryover from the year before, a thing called compartment syndrome, which I won't bore you with here. But so I was having to manage my season. So I literally was racing, and then I'd kind of got a lot of these little micro tears in my calf. I'd have to have 3-4 days off sometimes, 3-4 days after a race. So I'd be very careful with the race program through the summer. So I would have loved to have raced a little bit more in 85, but I couldn't because of my calf. And also, you know, you'd look back now, and again, if I was running, you know, around 1 mile race and 2 1500s, around 800, 1,000, 3,000, a 2,000 world record, you know, I was just like, oh, let's have a go at the breadth of, you know, of. Whereas now they'd probably go, wow, go and have another crack at, you know, I'm convinced when I broke the mile record, I could have run a second or two quicker. I'm convinced, maybe even on the night, but if you'd had another go. The 3:29 in Nice, you know, was a bit silly race, the way we ran it, and ran 52.9 last lap sort of thing, you know. So you kind of go, right, I'm in this shape. But I knew I was in good shape. People don't realise, there were two meets in Oslo in those days, and the first one was in June. And I went there, and I ran about 3:31. And it felt so easy, and I was like, "Whoa, you know, this, you know, I'm running really well," and that's why. But as I said, I had these problems with my calves, and oh, look, I could write a whole book just on 1985. But I'd gone to the British Championships, the 3 years championships, and entered the 800, and they really wanted me to run. It gets complicated here. It was the first year of ITV having a new contract, the first time we'd had a paid, you know, rights fee, and ITV were very keen on the, you know, which include the British Championships. I'd entered the 800, but I knew I was running in Nice on the Tuesday night, so only really wanted to run in the heats as a warm-up on the Saturday. I didn't really want to run in the final. On the Sunday, the championships didn't mean anything that year. We weren't getting selected for anything, as I said. And so I had to feign injury. When I finished my heat on Saturday evening, I sort of pretended to limp off the track, and so I had a bit of, but it was mainly because I wanted to be ready for Tuesday night. So I wanted to pull out of the final on the Sunday. The ITV lads who I knew got really upset about it. The guys who were looking after sponsors, and so there was a big confab held in the warm down area afterwards. And I was going, I'm going to Nice on Tuesday. Sorry, you know. So it's really hard to explain to people how big athletics was then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scrutiny and the new commercial world we were operating in, which had really only come in over the previous 2-3 years, and was very much part of. But going back to what I said, I was very much about sticking to my plan, and you know, winning the British Championships 800 meters wasn't really part of the plan. An 800 warm up was nice, and then went to Nice on the Tuesday night, and even that race had been set up. So, you know, the Olympics had been the year before. So you had Saeed Iwuita, who was the new 5,000-meter champion, who had beaten in the Worlds in 83. You had Joaquin Cruz, who was the 800-meter Olympic champion, who was said he was wanting to move up to 1,500, and myself. And actually, the race had been set up for Cruz, which was a bit odd because he wasn't really proven yet to be a 1,500-meter runner. So we didn't go through 1,000 meters that quick. And and you said which race was the most important. That one was the race before that in Oslo was pivotal because I knew I was in shape. Then I went, broke the world record in Nice in a very close race with Saeed Iwuita. And then the mile record was more of the kind of icing on the cake. That was the one I really wanted to have. And Seb was in the race and it was in Oslo, favorite track. My whole family were there. My family from Germany were there. I don't think I've ever in my whole career kind of gone into a race thinking I'm going to break the world record. But I think on that night, I sort of knew I was capable of doing that. Yeah. So, which is a nice place to be in. It doesn't happen that often.
Okay, yeah, I can't imagine many people can relate to that feeling. But it was in Nice. You broke 3:30 for the first time. You broke that barrier. Is that a bit of a watershed moment for you and 1500 meters?
Yeah, no, I mean, as I was just explaining, that night was about winning, and you know, as I said, the race had been set up for Cruz. When I got to 1,000 meters, I was feeling good, and it was fast, but it wasn't super fast, and I wasn't thinking about the record at all. I was thinking about beating Saeed, and he and I both had similar styles of running in that we would make it a bit of a long run from home. And I knew how strong he was. So I was a bit worried that he would get ahead of me. And, I thought I could, but I really wanted to be ahead of him. So coming down the home straight to the bell, I decided then to go and make it a long run from home from then. And I took him by surprise a little bit, which I didn't really know. I mean, I'm not looking behind. Down the back straight, I was motoring. Again, not thinking. And then there's a turn into home straight. I knew he was closing. You just hear from the crowd and I was starting to get a little bit tired. And the line took a long time to come and I outleaned and beat him by about half a yard. And only then did I look at the clock, And it was phenomenal, because both Saeed and I both ran under 3:30. And he was a nice guy, we were quite good friends. And we actually went out and celebrated pretty hard that night, which had another knock-on effect, which I haven't got time to talk to you about. But because I'd run that 3:31 in the small meet in Oslo about 3 weeks before, I sort of knew I was in shape to run well. But the point that night was there was these two Olympic champions in the race that it had been set up for, so the thing was to win the race. Whereas when I went to Oslo the second, you know, for the mile one, 10 days later or whatever it was, 10, 11 days later, even though Seb was in it and others, I was kind of, I remember getting to the bell on that night thinking, goodness, I feel so easy, but looked at the clock as well. Mm-hmm. And on that occasion, I wasn't thinking, how do I win this race? I was thinking, I mean, this sounds very arrogant, but I was thinking, can I run fast enough on the last lap, to get a good time, which is what happened, which is why I took off at the bell in Oslo as well, because I literally looked at the clock and went, whoa, that's a little bit slower than I thought, you know, and went off. But yeah, but it's quite hard, you know, these, you make it sound, or I can make this sound, I can't remember what it was, this, I was in an interview previously, whether I was talking about, you asked about what it was like when you were young and everything. You don't, you know, the process is the same when you're 16, 17. Because when you stand on the start line, it's still 3 3/4 laps.
Right.
And you've got a plan in your head, which is either about, I'm trying to run really fast today, so I'm going to go through 800 and X and, you know, whatever. And you're analyzing, how do I feel? Am I feeling good? Can I go a bit quicker? Should I back off? You know, all of that goes in your head. Or you are, I haven't beaten this guy. You know, he's from another club. I don't really know him very. Or you're in the English schools final or you know, and it's, you're trying, you just need to win. What's the tactic going to be like? Slow first lap. All of that is preparing you for when you're standing on the start line, and the next time you're going to run a personal best, it happens to be a world record. It's still my personal best. It's just that, you know, the context has moved on, and I've done this a whole bunch of times. You know, I've run a personal best 30 times since I was 13.
Mm.
You know, so the actual process is the same, and your thought process is building on all of the times you've done it before. It's just the context is a bit different. You know, and that's the thing I try and get across to people when they go, oh, you know, look at these guys, look at Ingebrigtsen, look at Josh Kerr. You go, they're just doing what they've done mm-hmm. all the way through their careers. But what sets them apart is that they can do it at the Olympic Games, at the World Championships. They can, you know, they can do it when it matters. And that's the key. So yeah, well, if you remember that, if you just try to remember that, you know, you're not trying to do, if you stand on a start line and are arrogant enough to go, I'm going to break the world record today, you know, you kind of go, it sounds arrogant, but it's literally what you're really saying is, I'm going to knock a half a second off my personal best, you know. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes it's more than that, but yeah. I mean, the reason I say that is that, prior to that and subsequent to that, I had some world record attempts where I had nobody to beat. It was just me and the clock. And then I never ran as well. I ran, you know, came close and, well, you missed it by, and there's nothing worse than crossing the line. I remember missing the world record in Brussels by about 0.3 seconds subsequent to this and feeling completely deflated, and went in the press box afterwards and everyone was like, oh, really sorry, you know, whatever. And I'm like, whoa. And then I had to kind of step back and go, well, hang on a minute, I'm not gonna break the world record every bloody week, you know. and actually I haven't done anything wrong and I didn't run badly and you know, yet it was very easy to get caught up in the sense of failure, which it also wasn't, you know. So you have to be cognizant of that as well, that you are once you start operating at that level, you're not going to keep breaking a world record every week, are you? You know, the best thing you can look for is some consistency at that level.
Amazing. And we've obviously talked a bit about 3:30 and 4 minutes for the mile. What do you think the next barrier in athletics for men or women is that's going to really capture the public imagination, and who do you think is going to break it?
Oh, man, well, I used to be able to chat about this 4 or 5 years ago, and now with super shoes, I haven't got a clue. You know, it almost seems like anything's possible. I suppose 140 in the 800, you know, we're looking for, because the shoes haven't made loads of difference in 400-800 meters. I mean, people are saying 4 minute mile for the women. I mean, it's a barrier, but that's a little way off. Yeah, you know, I it's hard, isn't it? I suppose, you know, the marathon, the 2 hour in a race is close now. So that's certainly it, and possibly 2:10 for the women. Can't believe I'm saying that. So there's a lot of things where you can set, but I think the 2 hour marathon one, because it's become part of the public consciousness a little bit more, and probably the women's 4 minute mile, as and when that happens, would be the big stories. You can make arbitrary kind of, you know, 2:10 for the marathon, or, you know, they've been 2:10, 2:12, whatever. It's whereas the 4 minute mile, I think, was such a big thing. You know, even going back a long time, first person running 10 seconds for the 100 meters, you know, all of those things. So there's plenty of barriers out there if you want to look at them that way. But yeah, shoes of technology generally, shoes, wave lights have helped an awful lot as well.
Mm. Steve, we'd love to talk to you about your coaching career as well.
Yeah.
Your opinions on modern day training principles, you know, double thresholds and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a bit curious about double. I think we, you know, I was doing that a long time ago, and never, but just didn't call it, you know, because if you did a hard workout and then went back on the track session that night, you know, that was my world. Not all the time, but so yeah, it seems strange that now suddenly people have decided that's, I think mainly through Inge Britsons, but you know, whatever you call things. A lot of the basics of being a good distance runner, and I include, you know, 800 as an endurance event, haven't changed. So, you know, if you get the basics right, you're giving yourself a platform to do well. And then I think there are quite, you know, there are many ways to skin a cat after that, because the trick is actually learning, coming back to what I was talking about before, the trick really then is once you can get somebody fit, you know, what are their attributes, the strengths that you can build on, and the weaknesses you really need to work on. And so the coach knowing the athlete and understanding the athlete is really important, and the athlete understanding themselves as well. What you know, not shying away from what you need to do. And yeah, you know, it's all right saying, you know, I trained hard. I got fed up with people saying, you know, you were just talented, you know, and then in consequent years, I used to think, wow, people, you know, we need to train harder. you know, and I think it's very easy for me to say that because I was pretty much full time. I think the biggest issue that is that these days is that, and I'll take Alex as a good example, you know, we've been able to do so much more this year because he was able to give up his job. He was able to give up his job because of one good performance last year, which enabled him to get, you know, a sponsorship deal, and that's enabled him to go away training altitude and more time to rest and recover, more time, you know, going to the gym, whatever. You know, and Alex was working in a coffee shop / bar, you know, and sometimes he'll be there till midnight, standing on his feet all day. So, you know, it's very easy to say what you need to do, but what are the circumstances of the athlete? What training can you load on them? What other pressures do they have? So I think coaching, the main thing I learned about coaching is not telling people what to do. It's understanding their circumstances, both their athletic capabilities, but also what they've got going on in their lives and what athletics means to them, how much they want to put into it, how much they can put into it. So that's, there's a skill there as much as there is about going to, you know, 10 400s with a minute interval or whatever, you know. It's, I think the other thing as well that, you know, from our day is just the amount of help and support that wasn't there, the science that is there now, nutrition. Yes, being able to diagnose injuries much more quickly and then rehab them in a much better way. I mean, all of that is I don't think athletes today kind of necessarily appreciate, because that's what they've grown up with. Mm. Whereas we are none of that, or very little of that. And so you had to learn a lot of that yourself to some extent, and use what was available where you could. Whereas now I can factor that in with the guys who I work with, without getting too, but I'm not one of those kind of controlling coaches either. The other side of it, let's say S&C, not my area, never learned enough about it, don't know enough about it. But because there are people who know that, you sit down and you find the right S&C person to work with your athlete, to work with the program that I'm giving them to make sure it works. And also I'm sitting down going, he or she needs to be better at this, better at that, needs to change this, needs to change that. So I like a collaborative approach as much as possible. And I think the biggest thing I can offer is where I think sometimes coaching can be challenging. When you get people who are very good and they get to the top level, going back to what I was saying a little while ago, choosing how to set your season and then how your race craft, and you can teach some of it, a lot of it you can't, it's going to come naturally, but coaches who've got a lot of experience in that world, I'm quite lucky, I've been there myself and done it, that's a massive help as well. I think particularly for young developing athletes, it's a big, don't do this, don't do this. How many 800 races have I watched? How many 1500 meters races have I watched and run in? And the hardest thing is to go to people, don't do that. Oh, but fine, go and do it. And then they come back, well, are you all right? And it's, and that's fine. People have to find out for themselves, but you kind of going, look, I've been there, I've seen it, I've done it, I've watched it, do that, because, and I enjoy it, it's good. I don't have time to coach lots of people. I have chats with people like this, but in terms of, I'm very much a believer that if you're going to have that type of coach, I like athletes to be a little bit in control of what they're doing to some extent. I'm here to help facilitate, try and educate to some extent, but you're building year on year on year on year. And if the athlete isn't learning and taking control, then you're going to struggle somewhere down the line. Any athlete who I coach, let's say, for instance, if Alex gets the Olympic Games, I'm going to be in the commentary booth. I'm not going to be standing there at the warm-up track going, ooh, I'm not sure you drill. You have to take control of that yourself. Mm. And that's, that I'm a big believer in that. That relationship changes with athletes and coaches, and it should change. And, it's an individual sport when it boils down to it out there in the arena. So, it's a combination of that collaborative approach, but it has to be led by the athlete.
Very interesting. And on the kind of topic of professionalism, like you mentioned with Alex and kind of the benefits of the increased money, what are your quick thoughts on the recent announcement of the 50K prize money for the Olympics this summer?
I don't have a problem with it. I really don't understand what the issue is here. I mean, the professional era disappeared the amateur era disappeared a long, long, long time ago. World Athletics are doing their best to try and, we've got to keep the Olympics relevant, and if people are getting, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars for running in races somewhere else, marathon runners, for instance, and yes, the Olympics are still relevant, but increasingly it's becoming difficult in a world where people are just looking at their commercial opportunities more and more and more. So I don't have a problem with it, because even back in my day, I ran against people who, when they went home, their government paid them for winning an Olympic medal, whether they were Russia or Kenyan or Spanish, or I could list a whole bunch of countries who were paying Olympic medalists. It wasn't from their federation. This happens to be our world federation saying, we receive, which they do, a big chunk of money from the IOC for being part of the Olympic Games. And that money shouldn't just go into our coffers.
Mm.
So that money should be used for helping federations. And they've taken the view, and I don't have a problem with it, of rewarding athletes as well. And I really don't have a problem with that. And yes, someone might say, you know what? Olympic gold medalists, they're all going to earn loads of money. Well, sadly, they don't. Mm. I promise you, if you win the Olympic discus title, that might be your biggest payday. Right? So people forget, you know, that not everybody is going to get big multi, you know, if you win the Olympic steeplechase, it might, you know, might help you get better, you're in the Diamond League and all the rest of it. And you might have a shoe bonus. But it's, I don't have a real problem with it at all. It's part of the world that we live in. It's underlining from the Federation that the Olympics are important still. And we want the best athletes to go. And one way to incentivize people, as it is everywhere else, is to pay them.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel it's put a price on an Olympic medal, though? Whereas before, we used to assume, you know, it's priceless, but now it could be associated with, it's only worth £50,000. The ultimate prize in track and field is £50,000.
No, and I don't think you'll find any athlete who's gone to the Olympic Games trying to win a medal is thinking about the 50,000. Because, by the way, for most of them, it's not money, is it? So I think it's an attempt. And yes, they obviously want to introduce more money to silver and gold, silver and bronze in 28 as well. I just think it's a move in the right direction, but I don't think it changes, certainly won't change how athletes think about going to the Olympic Games. I think the danger for the Olympics is that as we go forward, you know, and they start to look at other sports as part of the Olympic movement, which are bringing money in, and that includes things like esports. You know, how does track and field maintain its spot as the top Olympic sport, which is what it likes to say it is. But how do we ensure that? You know, one of the things, you have to have our best people taking part at the Olympics. And this is part of the way to do that. But I think for certainly in the foreseeable future, now in the next 2-3 Olympiads, the vast majority of people are going to the Olympics because they want to become an Olympic champion. And you know, and the things that come afterwards, because I've heard people say, oh, you know, it'll affect motivation. Well, rubbish, you know. Everyone knows that in the 1500, in the 100 metres, in most of the events, winning an Olympic gold medal might set you up for life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and nobody goes into the race thinking about that. You never do. You can't do. Mm-hmm. So, but that's what comes afterwards. Same with prize money and whatever else. So, I don't have a problem with it.
Awesome. We've given us some great insights throughout this podcast, but I guess I just wanted to end on a little bit of advice for those who are going to run the Bannister Mile coming up. And is the mile in the 1500, it's classed as the same event, but are there differences? Is training different? Is the way you approach it any different?
I don't think so. Certainly training isn't any different. I think you obviously have to, you know, what is it, 7 or 8% further. So you just have to kind of, I haven't done my math right probably there, but you just need to work that into your plan around your race. So in some respect, it's a little bit easier because it's 400-bit laps, but, you know, it divides up a little bit more easily. But I think essentially it's the same event. So, but I think the great thing about the mile is, you know, you are, that's why I love the fact that we're having, you know, the Bannister Mile and celebrating the mile, and the miles make a bit of a comeback, certainly in America and around the world. We want to, it's a great distance with a great heritage, and it's that heritage that you're really celebrating and you're trying to be part of. And, you know, people still go, how quick can you run a mile? I still get asked, how quick could you still run a mile? Nobody says, how quick could you still run a 1500 meters? I don't know why, but that's what they do. The answer is not very fast, by the way. But no, treat it the same event. You know, it's 4 laps, work out your pace, which is a bit easier to do over 4 laps. Just make sure you remember that you're part of a great piece of history.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time today. We thought before we let you go, we'll ask you some quick fire short answer questions. First one, who's the greatest 1500 mile runner of all time?
For the purpose of this, I'll say Roger Bannister, just because of what he did.
Fantastic. Who wins Olympic gold in Paris in that men's 1500?
Josh Kerr.
Is Jakob going to break the 1500 mile world records? If not, how long could El Guerrouj's records last?
I think the answer to that is no, and probably not very long.
Wow. Who do you think could break it in the next few years?
I think just given where the guys are going with shoes and everything, that if they get, you know, if they get together, so I think for Jakob at the minute, he's got to concentrate and get himself fit and ready to compete at the Olympics. And I think the 5,000 is just always a distraction. If you want to break the 15, if he wants to go quicker at 1500, remember I said earlier on, he just needs to concentrate on that now. I don't think he's going to do it all off his strength. He's probably reached just about the limit he can with that. So it's going to need somebody. It may be, you know, the Josh Kerrs of this world, but it may be somebody else the next 4 or 5 years that comes along with the benefit of shoes, who's got a good 8:15 pedigree.
Okay. Well, Cram, thank you very much. And we'll see you on the 6th of May at the Bannister Miles. You'll be present that day, won't you? And I believe you've got James Young running as well. So,
James is going to have his season opener there, which he's in Portugal at the minute, getting a little bit of sunshine, bless him. But look forward to that.
Fantastic. We'll let you get off and watch the Boston Marathon and enjoy. And take care.
Thanks.
Great to hear from Krami there, another stellar guest to add to our lineup, if we do say so ourselves. Obviously, speaking about those Bannister Miles as well. So as Matt said before the episode, make sure you get yourself down there if that's something you want to do. And also get racing as well, because Matt, is there still spots for entries as well?
Still spots for entries. I think on the track, you need to be sub 440 to make the cut. To be able to do the mile on the track, but if not, there's a community mile on the road as well. You can get involved in that. That'll be in the morning. And those elite miles, and I think if you're a woman, it's 5 minutes. You got a break to be able to run on the track as well.
Nice. And then just before we end this, wrap up this episode. There's not too many races coming up, but we thought we'd preview some of them. Obviously, Comeback 5000 next weekend. We're expecting to see kind of our first few fast times of the season in the UK anyway. Obviously, we've seen some abroad over on those bouncy boards in Boston. So, Matt, talk us through some of these fields.
They're stellar, to be honest. I think it's encouraging to see so many top Brits are going to take to track. Look, I think it's been made known already, hasn't it, that they want to see those European standards ticked off. So who have we got on that men's side? I mean, actually, a name that I think not enough people are talking about is James Gormley. Personal best, 13:25. He's a great, great runner. He's got a quick 1500 in him, and actually kind of what he's up to. He is definitely a future guest for the podcast. And I think he was still working with Ben Thomas the last we heard. But that was last year. So I'm not sure what he's been up to, but he is someone who I think is a dark horse, and he will get, you know, he will nail that race. He only kind of races when he's really ready to rock and roll as well. So I bet he's in fine tune just to put the pressure on him a little bit. And then you've got the Hoka boys. So you've got Ellis Cross, you've got Rory Leonard, James McMurray's in there, whether he's doing it or pacing it. I think Scott Beatty might be pacing as well. I know Leonard wants that time. And then you've got a load of men who I think it's going to be kind of two races, because you've got those guys, those select few who are going to try hit that 13:20 mark. James Kingston as well. I'd be interested to see where he kind of fits into that race, because like I said, you've got boys trying to run 13:20, and then realistically you're looking at a load of men running 13:50. So whether they'll have two paces or someone who's in that kind of chase group is going to have to take the race on by the scruff of the neck, and they're going to have to help each other out. I mean, James Dargan, good youngster, went to World Cross. Quinn Meal Ingram as well, great youngster, these under 20s, stepping up in the five. So they'll be looking to break that 14-minute barrier. So I think there'll be quite a few sub-14s, but it's just how that chase group hands out a little bit.
Yeah, you'd think they should have a pacer really for a sub-14, shouldn't they?
Yeah, you'd hope they do. And then Scott Sterling as well, actually, he's in there. So just another another entry to mention. Yeah, you'd hope they do, but yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it ends up being that the B race is actually better for a sub 14 because the A race is, like you say, it's 13:20 and then everyone's dying. And then you get the B race that they'll go off at 14:10 pace. But a few of them will break away, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then just on a couple of other athletes racing, this is not at the Comeback 5000, but in Huelva in the Tuesday after, so 30th of April, I've seen Charlie Wheeler and Zach Mohammed are in that 5K and it looks pretty hot. There's some top Europeans in there. I think Grecia was entered, like the 1500 looks strong as well. So, and we know that Huelva track's fast. But that's just me digressing, talking about 5K running. And then in the women's field as well, you've got Kate Axford, Georgia Bell was the big one, and for me, Georgia Greck as well, coming off of that World Cross. Jenny Nesbitt as well. But yeah, and I think those women, again, it's going to be a similar setup to the kind of men's race where you're going to have women going for sort of, well, basically looking at that 15-minute barrier, and then you're going to have a load of women trying to break 16.
Yeah, I think that's probably the big difference, isn't it, between the UK 5,000, 10,000 meter running and what you can get abroad is that we do have those kind of standout athletes at the top, but the depth behind it is always a bit lacking.
Yeah, that's it. But that's fine. I mean, it's still going to be some good racing going down. And
absolutely. And I think sometimes it's easier for the top athletes to race without so many people jostling around them. As long as you've got 4 or 5 of you, I think that's plenty.
Yeah, you need to get pace to 3K, and then you need to be able to have sort of 2 or 3 people that you can work off. But it does, like I said, it can get a bit cagey, can't it? Because if there's 3 or 4 of you, that poor person who's left out front once the pacer drops out, that's a tough gig. And how they kind of cope with that and respond. But Georgia Bell, we've seen it time and time again. She's happy to get out front and just front run. And that's something I wouldn't be surprised if she does. I mean, looking at these start lists, it's going to be between, yeah, her, Nesbitt and Axford, to be honest with you. All of them kind of can go run 15 minutes for 5K. So we'll see. And talking of Axford, just signed with Kiprun. Looks like Wheeler Boys might sign with Kiprun as well. Rumors floating around. Nothing's been officially announced yet, but Kiprun making absolute moves in the sport, Lum.
Yeah, they are. Obviously, I think it was a bit of a surprise for everyone when we saw Chilima rock out with Kiprun. What was it, beginning of last summer? But they've done it in other sports as well. Decathlon's kind of sports brands have gone after a few big hitters in other sports in recent years, and now they're translating that to track and field as well. So it's always good to see another player out there. And I think as well, like it's quite nice to see the athletes will be rocking what is a relatively budget, a budget shoe or a budget spike for the general consumer. But actually what Decathlon are trying to do is produce stuff that is good enough for the pros, but still putting it at a price point that's appropriate for kind of the general consumer as well. Like they're not wearing anything different to what the people are able to buy, you know?
So this is the interesting debate, right? So you've got Kiprun, who have crazy amounts of money, like they're the huge, huge company. And if you're an athlete, do you choose to go to Kiprun because you're going to get financially, you're going to be a lot better off. They're just going to be able to chuck a load of cash away, which is what they've been doing. Or do you go with a brand who like an established brand, like maybe you go with you go join a Puma group, a non-group, something like that. Like Honor, a prime example, right? You go with a brand, you take less money, you go with them, but you've got all the support, all the setup, and you've got loads of contacts who are in the know. They're going to help you out. You know, you're going to get the best medical advice, this, that, altitude advice, all this kind of extra shenanigans that goes with being an elite. And it's kind of picking which one is best, isn't it? And I think that's where athletes have found themselves. I mean, but
it depends how good your agent is.
How good your agent is and stuff, but like I see is because I think a lot of people are not frowning on Kiprun, but they're kind of like, oh, you know, they're throwing money around. Good. Like if that means that these other brands have to pull their finger out in order to sign athletes, good. And it might take a couple years. But I'm pleased that they're able to do that. And you know what? I'm pleased that, you know, someone like Axford, like we don't know any details, but someone like Axford is able to be financially stable and actually, you know, have what we could class as like a full-time job, not be dished out 20K. Because we know 20K, like as an athlete, I mean, as a normal person,
20K people are being dished out 5K.
Well, yeah, less than that. Yeah. But even, I'm just saying like even 20K doesn't really stretch, does it? When you're trying to travel and do X, Y, and Z, and you get it in installments instead of like a regular paycheck, like, you know, it's quite challenging. So yeah, I'm pleased that they are kind of stepping foot into this market and they are looking to push on. And in fact, to get Brits on board, I mean, we've seen Donnelly and Goodall as well sign with them. So I'm pleased.
Yeah, I think it's always good to see athletes getting supported. So, and like you say, if it makes kind of the more established brands kind of start paying more or doing whatever it is, again, we don't know the ins and outs of people's contracts. Then that's always a good thing, isn't it?
Absolutely, man.
Cool. Well, I think that's about it, isn't it, mate? Nothing much else to preview.
No, I think, yeah, that's coming up. I think we've got another Diamond League in Shanghai next week as well. So look out for that one, obviously off the back of Xiaomen. And then Doha's around the corner. And obviously, I hope you all enjoyed the London Marathon, because obviously that's been taking place this weekend. It's been an epic weekend for racing. There's been multiple results in America by the time you're listening. Obviously, we can't list off those results. But yeah, by the time you're listening, there'll be... The Mount Sac was going down. You've got Virginia Challenge. You've got we're going to be races in America pretty much every weekend now as well. So there's a lot going on. We'll try and keep you informed each weekend as we move forward, because track season has commenced.
Yeah, thanks for listening, guys. We'll catch you with probably a London review next before our main episode next weekend.